Welcome to the Dallas Soccer Show. I'm Dustin Nation, and I'm here with Tristan Vick. How's it going, Tristan?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Oh, you know, another day in paradise. So, on this week's show, we're going to do a deep dive into the problems that FC Dallas and the U.S. men's national team are both having defensively. We're going to start off with a quick roundup of the FC Dallas versus Atlanta beating. You could do a sports crossover and call it a Atlanta thrashing, but that would probably be too much of a stretch.
So. We're not all hockey fans. We're not all hockey fans.
Anywho, so buckle up. This could get into turn into a heated episode. But so Tristan, why don't you start us off with the FC Dallas versus Atlanta game?
Yeah. So this past weekend, Atlanta United opened up their new stadium, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. It's a brilliant-looking, very modern, retractable roof-style stadium deep in the heart of Atlanta. The stadium itself seats about 42,000 and is expandable up to like 70 or 80. And it was always going to be a raucous atmosphere. I think they had somewhere close to like 45 or maybe even 50,000. 45,000 there. And the place was rocking the entire match. Very hostile environment. At the end of the day, the match really came down to defense playing incredibly well. Two goalkeepers, Guzan and Jesse Gonzalez, having insane matches. Gonzalez had seven saves in the match, which was season high. But at the end of the day, FC Dallas just couldn't keep that pressure out. And Atlanta takes an early lead. And then the worst time to let a goal in, as everybody knows, is right before halftime, because then your team's just deflated going into the half. But the second worst time to let a goal in is obviously right after the second half starts. It completely changes the game plan and the way that you were going to approach that second half. And once Joseph Martinez scores that goal, Miguel Almiron, who was just all over the place for Atlanta, sets him up, and our defense just loses all confidence after that. And at that point, it was really tough for FC Dallas to establish a lot of possession until they went up 3-0 when Greg Garza, the Dallas guy, or the Dallas homegrown boy, put Atlanta up 3-0. Again, another defensive lapse, and at the same time, FC Dallas still pushed the pressure. They still created some opportunities. Kellen Acosta had a couple of chances that probably he should have converted, at least one that was just set right up for him, and he ended up just slamming the ball right into the ground, straight into Guzan's chest. It was quite an easy save. He didn't really try to direct the ball anywhere, just straight on target with the keeper. But that was probably our best chance and opportunity of the match. There were others, and we created good possession and good opportunities going forward. But you said it in the intro. The defense played really bad. I think Hernan Grana has gone from a hero to some people to just a complete goat. And I don't mean greatest of all time. I mean, he just looks lost at times. Whether he has the ball, whether he's marking someone, he looks a step slow when he's chasing somebody down the wings, but I would be very surprised to see him starting this weekend against Seattle. What about you? What did you take away from this atrocious performance by the defense?
Well, let's not bury the lead here, Tristan. FC Dallas was on
the new stadium, right?
No, not the Sphincter Dome. Actually, FC Dallas being on the receiving end of a VAR turnover.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
Yes, they finally overturned a decision in our favor.
And it didn't help much.
No.
Other than the VAR, I don't want to take anything away from Atlanta. They played well, as they have been all season. You just would have liked to have seen a little bit more charisma, a little bit more chutzpah from the FC Dallas players.
Chaputzpah.
I don't have any idea what that actually means. So if it's a bad word, I'm sorry, Mom.
It's okay. There's not too many Yiddish speakers from Oklahoma.
That's true. Anyway, so yeah, you would have hoped to see a little bit more urgency from FC Dallas, even after that second goal. You know, we were up by two against Houston, and they came back and tied us. So, you know, being down by two is not an insurmountable task. Maybe it was that night just because of the way Atlanta was playing and the way FC Dallas was set up. But you know, you really would have wished, you would have liked to have seen them come out, even after giving up that goal, just, you know, coming out and getting stuck into challenges, trying to boss Atlanta around a little bit more. And, but you just, it looked like you said it, the, it was just deflating. They were deflated. And yeah,
I think that's an important point. The role of a defense is to support the rest of the team and give them give the midfield especially confidence going forward. But in this match, instead, what you had was you had a goalkeeper that was frustrated at his back line for letting in the quick front attacking players on the Atlanta United, getting in the channels. I mean, Almiron basically had all day to run around. The penalty decision that was overturned was a direct result of our inability to pick up runners through the channels. It really goes to show you that the zonal marking system that they've been using is one that requires not just some positioning knowledge and ability to position yourself, but a lot of communication and picking up people running through the midfield or running through the middle onto balls is defending 101. And I think that we've kind of, as Carter Baum talked about a couple weeks ago, that they've kind of thrown the book at the wall and saw what's and tried to see what sticks to get us out of the funk. And I think they're still trying stuff. And maybe they need to go back to what they did at the beginning, which was playing a little bit more conservative, but at the same time, but they allowed Kellen to get forward, kind of create some, be a kind of a target person, but also run on the balls and just kind of be creative. Instead, the defense looks very hesitant. Our wing backs are just, I felt like Figueroa played decently at times, but still, if you were curious, they always went down their left flank and Grana was just picked on constantly. And, yeah. And so you'll have to, I mean, it's rough sometimes, but I feel like he's just two steps too slow against some of these faster teams. It'll be interesting to see how they come against Seattle this weekend with no Jordan Morris, potentially. You'll have Christian Roldan. I mean, you've got some speed out there, though, that you're going to have to account for.
Yeah, and earlier in the season, we went to the Houston game. I forget which month it was. I think it was a 0-0 draw at Toyota Stadium. And one of the things that I was pointing out was that Grana is just getting beat by DeMarcus Beasley's speed. He just had no answer for it over and over again. And you saw in that game against Atlanta over the weekend that Grana was caught watching twice for two of their goals. And then on that second goal, what was Zimmerman even doing? As soon as he pushed forward and made that little, I don't even know what he was, what to call it, but he basically got the ball and then kind of tried to play it out, but then misplayed it and then just turned it right over. And as soon as they did that, I was just thinking to myself, oh, this is not going to turn out well. And sure enough, we got punished for it.
Yeah, the way that the players are reacting to mistakes is very worrying because this is a team that's supposed to be known for their quick style of play, a team that's able to push the tempo of the match. And what you have are two different mindsets. And you have a mindset of quick, up-tempo attacking football. And then in the back line, you have a very much more stoic approach to defending that kind of relies on not being put in situations that could potentially exploit those slower center backs. And Hedges really has looked off the pace. I'm surprised the way that he reacted in this match to some of those passes that you're mentioning. And yeah, Zimmerman on the second goal was just, it was pretty shocking. I think that, I don't know what it is about it that they haven't gotten through to him, but it was pretty bad. And if it weren't for Gonzalez, this could have been a much worse match. Could have been 5 or 6-0 easily.
Yeah. So let's talk about the FC Dallas defense going back over the past couple of matches. So I went back and I watched the highlights and I watched all the goals that were scored against us from the Atlanta, the New York Red Bull game, the Columbus game, Houston, the 3-3 draw, the Sporting Kansas City 2-0 loss, the Colorado 0-0 draw, and the Philadelphia Union 3-0 loss. And so here's okay. So setting it up, in those seven games, we let in 15 goals. Four of them were on set pieces, and one of them was off of a throw-in, which is like, so we'll call it 4.5 set pieces. And four of the goals, Grana had a direct hand in. Two were Zimmerman errors. Two were Hedges. And like you said earlier, one of the biggest problems is you see players just completely splitting our defense over and over again. It's that zonal marking that you were referring to, and the lack of communication between the players. And I don't know whether, you know, it's the heavy rotation the back gets, that's the problem, the center backs get there, that causes that problem, but it is definitely one of the problems. And Oscar Pereira likes to play that 4-2-3-1, which I know not everybody who listens to the show is a huge soccer nerd. Well, okay, if you're listening to a FC Dallas podcast, you probably are a huge soccer nerd. But if you're, just in case you're not, what that means is that they play with four defensemen, two defensive midfielders in front of them, three attacking midfielders, and then a lone striker. And so with four defensive players, you've got two center backs, which kind of stand right in front of the goalie, and then you've got two fullbacks. So the way FC Dallas uses our fullbacks, especially Hernan Grana, is that they're really not defensive players more as much as they are wing players. And they go up and down the sidelines. And what you'll see is that they spend so much time going forward that it's really hard for them to recover and come back and help the center backs. And when you've got a player like Kellen Acosta sitting in the two defensive midfield spots that Pereira likes to play with, you got Acosta there who... He describes himself as a player who is a box to box midfielder. So he likes to get up and get forward and get into the opposing player's box. Well, that just leaves one player, most likely Grezo or Victor Ulloa, whoever's playing alongside Acosta. That's the only cover that the center backs have. You've got two defensive player and one defensive midfielder to deal with anything that comes back in a hurry. And when that happens, when they come back, it's one mistake and you're done. And when you've got Hedges and Zimmerman both having really rough seasons as far as making errors go, you're going to expect goals to be let in whenever you got your fullbacks up as far and you're playing in a configuration like this. You look at Liverpool, they play a very similar system with their wingers basically providing the width, or sorry, their fullbacks providing the width to the team up and down the sidelines. And you're going to expect goals to get let in, but you're counting on scoring goals. And that's just something we haven't done. And so it just basically makes us look like we're getting rolled over when we really should just be scoring more goals. It's kind of a tough situation. And yeah, I think,
well, what you're saying is all predicated on the assumption that those center midfielders are making smart decisions and that they're not being put in really crappy positions. And what you're seeing is that they are getting put in crappy positions where they have to pick between two forwards to run onto and mark versus being able to pick up either the person with the ball or just the lone man. Instead, our center backs are getting out of position. The wing backs aren't cutting over quick enough, if at all. And so the center midfielders are forced to kind of make a decision about the least of two enemies. And in every case, that's going to create offensive opportunities that really will expose the defense of FC Dallas in each match.
Yes, that's a good point. And I think if we're going to fix this, I think that it starts there in the midfield. I don't know whether it's playing with one defensive midfielder dedicated instead of two, or whether it's actually, like you said earlier, going back to what we did in this season, in the early parts of the season, and kind of hunkering down more and then playing on the break, which would mean that instead of having Acosta go forward a whole bunch, his main responsibility would be defense. I don't know if that's the answer. I would bet that they are experimenting with this and probably, I sure hope they figure it out.
So I think the biggest issue, if you look at FC Dallas tactically, is that the coaches need to sit down with the defense and explain how they want the attacks to build. They need to explain better and just drill into each of the players their responsibilities for starting attacks, for finishing attacks, for covering on the defense on the counterattacks, because that's where it's all breaking down. The second goal was just a terrible, terrible, terrible miscommunication by Zimmerman and just a horrible touch. The third goal was Hedges not being able to get to the ball and cut on a pass, and so somebody's wide open running in, taps it in. I think we really and truly are seeing players that don't know what their responsibilities are supposed to be, or they're confused. And that's where the coaching staff needs to come in and sit down and kind of go back to basics with regards to how do we build attacks out of the back. Gonzalez is not always the most accurate on his free kicks. So it wouldn't surprise me if on the goal kicks, instead of playing it long, that we kind of play it out of the back more often going forward. But again, that helps build those confidence. And then that confidence is what can lead to those attacks that we had in the first half of the season. Kellen Acosta wants to play forward. In interviews, he says he wants to play forward. He knows that that's not always a position that he's needed. And so he's pushed into this deep lying position where he's kind of sitting in front of the back four and then playing more of a box to box style. I think it's not a bad idea to see what we do, like what you said, where somebody is really given true defensive responsibilities and then we push Kellen up more and we're able to play a little bit more direct. FC Dallas is going against Dempsey, who this weekend, and Dempsey is, gosh, I think he's close to 35. So he's not going to be the quickest player, but if you can shut down the passing and the creativity that Dempsey has, then you're going to really stifle a lot of the opportunities that Seattle creates. And that frees up some of the midfield to focus on creating those attacks. I hope that's what happens. Nothing has shown anything to indicate that's what will happen. So as much as we can talk about all the ways that you can fix the problem, I mean, the reality is that Hedges looks slow to the ball, slow to react. Zimmerman looks confused, tactically unaware of where he needs to be playing the ball. And Grana looks not only out of position, but he is clearly someone that people are targeting, that teams are targeting in order to exploit holes in the defense of FC Dallas.
Yeah, he had a couple of good games there where he was actually, he made some really good defensive stops and read the ball really well. But before and after those couple of good games, he's been kind of having some nightmares out there.
Oh yeah, no, it was a culmination of a lot of bad matches, but at the same time,
I wonder if it has anything to do with whether he's wearing the orange boots or the blue boots.
I highly doubt it. I do not think that matters, but I think it does have to do with the tactics that they've been set up with and some pressure. Every match cannot be, let's get off the schneid. I think we need to get back to what worked for the team in the past and how do we focus on doing what we do well and not focusing on our mistakes so much, as individuals should focus on the mistakes and they should work individually with certain players. But as a team, I think they really need to integrate a little bit better from a passing standpoint, from a tactic standpoint, and how do they keep the ball in the other half of the field so that the defense can play further up and kind of absorb some pressure potentially. Sure. By creating a little bit of an offsides trap in the way that they set up.
So of the 15 goals that FC Dallas has let in the past 7 games, 5 of them have been on set pieces. And I think this is another example of the players not really fully understanding who they're supposed to be marking, what they're supposed to be doing in this. I mean, it looks like most of the time they're doing zonal marking, and it's just like in open play, when you got players splitting them, they're getting split in the set pieces as well. I've never understood zonal marking on set pieces. I've watched it in the Premier League and I've watched it in La Liga, whenever I see the zonal marking, it gets beaten more than it seems to actually work. And so what do you think about zonal marking on set pieces?
I have been somebody who feels like zonal marking is situation dependent. When you're playing a team that is very physical, like Stoke, or a team like even Atletico Madrid, those types of teams that have a lot of physicality, it's important that you have somebody on, you have a man on each person, and man marking is really important. You can get away with zonal marking against those teams too, though, if they don't have a lot of speed and they aren't very intricate in the way or technical in the way that they handle set pieces. I'm a fan of man marking, but I feel like it requires confidence that people aren't going to get to your outside or even on your inside. The way that man marking works is when you're up against a defender during a set piece, or up against a forward or an opponent during a set piece, is you want to be within arm's reach of that person so that you can deflect and interfere with any attempt that they have to play the ball. And most of all, you want to be between them and the ball. But if they break away and get behind you, obviously you have to win the ball, or else they have a clear path to goal. And zonal marking creates zones of responsibility that can also have gaps of responsibility where there's overlaps. And so someone can get somewhere that they are not covered. And so
either our gaps are really big or other teams are really good at finding our gaps.
Right. And if you look at the passes that were played this weekend, zonal marking only works if you're able to intercept and create some pass breakups. And that was not happening. And the result of that was, at least in my opinion, two goals. You could argue the third goal too, the second goal as well. And so that's the biggest problem, is you're creating situations where if someone doesn't do their job, the likelihood of scoring is much higher. I'm surprised that only 5 of the 15 goals that you researched there came from set pieces, because last season we had a very strong defense that kept out a lot of goals that weren't set pieces. And when you do that, that obviously gives your offense more time to score and not play from behind. And so that's kind of surprising that we don't have more goals scored from set pieces. But again, it comes back to whether it's zonal marking or man marking, it's about individuals playing up to the responsibilities that the coaching staff's given them. So yeah, it clearly didn't look like they were doing that this weekend.
Yeah, and before we move on, I'm generally a pretty positive person, so I would like to leave this section of the show on a high note. We've touched on it earlier. I'd like to really point out and give kudos to the goalkeeping players. So between Jesse Gonzalez and Chris Seitz, there were a lot of times where they kept us in games when we didn't really have any business being in the games. And so if you're listening, Chris Seitz and Jesse Gonzalez, round of applause to you, sirs. They're not listening.
You mean Guzan? You're saying Seitz?
Seitz played in the Philadelphia game, and he made a lot of really good saves.
Yeah. No, I agree. The goalkeepers played really well.
So, yes, there's our end on a positive note. The Dallas Soccer Show, your source of FC Dallas banter and U.S. men's national team news and coverage.
All right, so let's go to Alexi Dynamite, as I like to call him, the great American legend that whenever you talk to somebody not from America about American soccer players, one of the players they always know was Alexi Lawless. And he had some choice words this week during the Fox broadcast about the U.S. men's national team. Called them soft. He felt like the reputation of Arena is taking a hit now too. It's not just Klinsmann's fault. He said that they were underperforming tattooed millionaires. I, for one, and then he called out the Wonder Kid, which is Christian Pulisic. And he basically said that they aren't playing up to the expectations that fans have. I've got one issue with this, and then I have a general comment that I think is kind of supportive of it. It's funny that they talk about all of these showboats basically in soccer when if you go back to what Alexi Lalas used to actually be when he was the GM of LA Galaxy, he was the guy that signed Beckham and showboated about his signature moves for the franchise. So Alexi's got a little bit of his own showboat streak to him. And I mean, if you just look at what he wore or what he looked like when he played,
the big old
there's some showboating
hair
there too. Yeah. The red hair and the big goatee. Mm-hmm. So, and it wasn't like he was anything spectacular when he played. That being said, Alexi makes a couple of good points about the fact that they are underperforming and that at times they are soft. My biggest issue with this is that that is not a choice necessarily that Arena can't not make. He's kind of stuck with the talent pool that he has. If you look at the way we've picked squads for the U.S. men's national teams for essentially the past 8 years since the 2009 Confederations Cup, there's always been a Jozy Altidore, a Michael Bradley, a Tim Howard, and now it's Jeff Cameron, but it used to be guys like Ngucci Onyewu and DeMarcus Beasley. And those were just our limitations. We couldn't pick anyone else. Now, if you want Bradley to be the enforcer, he'll be the enforcer. But I feel like most people think Bradley is more valuable playing more up top, creating the opportunities from the top and going forward that way. Now, what's the specific criticism that he has of the team as a whole? It's that they really and truly aren't living up to the expectations of soccer fans, which is, I think, a great thing to see. Mm-hmm. The only sport in America besides hockey that we are judged as a nation against other nations, and basketball to some extent, but that's really not a competition, is soccer. And that means that we have to have the same types of pressure that the other sports have on our athletes that represent us, whether it's at a World Cup qualifying match or a friendly match or the Olympics or Olympic qualifiers, because we haven't made one in over 8 years. And so I think it's good that Alexi's calling these people out. But at the same time, I think Alexi needs to provide some solutions. I mean, if you're going to call out the players themselves, you should call out the culture that created them. We have a system in America where you have to pay to play soccer at a youth level. And if you're good, the chances of you getting spotted are much greater if you're able to start early paying into those systems where you play on the regular field that everyone else in your area or your city plays in, that you can afford to make it to the practices and that you can afford to make it on the travel teams and the hotels and all of these aspects of these unforeseen costs that create our team, so to speak, that we can pick from. And when you look at a guy like Clint Dempsey, I mean, Dempsey lived in a trailer park in Nacogdoches, Texas, and was actually told, like, your sister is a really good tennis player. We're going to put our money behind her because we can't afford both. And tragically, his sister died like a couple months later from a brain aneurysm. And Dempsey obviously is heartbroken, but every day now he plays for his sister's memory. And that allowed him to have that ability to go to Dallas every night and play. Now, Pulisic did the same thing. He challenged himself by going abroad. But I want to know what steps Alexi would want to see for us to prevent this type of culture from finding guys like Clint Dempsey going forward. And there aren't a ton of good answers besides the development academies. And I don't know, Dustin, I think that if you're going to develop players, players should be able to make some money when they go abroad. And right now their local clubs don't get paid when an MLS player gets signed from a local travel club or a development club and then gets sold on. They're not getting paid. When Tottenham signed DeAndre Yedlin after the 14 World Cup, they asked, where do they send the, it's called like a academy development payment is what it's called. And it's really common in Europe.
Right.
But it doesn't happen here. And so when they asked who do they pay the $50,000 or $100,000 or whatever for the development fee for Yedlin, they were like, oh, you don't. It's MLS. You're buying him from MLS. Seattle will get someone. They're like, no. Like DeAndre Yedlin played for a club before he got signed for his professional team. Like, who is that club? They wanted to pay whoever it was. And they're like, well, he played at Akron, but they're like, no. Like Emerald City FC, the Seattle program that he played for. And so these types of things are what we create, these development teams that allow for players to get spotted if we were able to support them better financially. And we have a lot of money in the game, and that's good. But you can criticize the players for being overpaid, but at the same time, who would he like to replace some of these guys with?
Yeah, listen, you've touched on a lot of stuff there. And I think, you know, I'm gonna circle back to what started the whole thing off with the Alexi Lalas comments. And you saw it really resonate with a bunch of soccer fans on Twitter. You saw that the Total MLS tweet just blow up, and you saw it on everybody's feeds. And I think what that really speaks to, it resonated because, like you said, we are starting to have higher expectations. When we demanded that Klinsmann get fired is because he wasn't living up to expectations. We want to see them achieve something. And like you said, that is a good thing, that the desire to succeed is always a good thing. Now, as far as him calling out everybody, I don't know that Pulisic necessarily deserved to be called out there. But like you said, the general sentiment there, I think most people can get behind, that they need to suck it up. They need to figure out a way to win. As far as how to go about doing that and the culture in U.S. soccer, I mean, that is a tall order. It is a large hole that we as a soccer nation have dug ourselves into. And I just don't see it, you know, really getting much better anytime soon. It's going to be a long haul out of that pit there that we've dug for ourselves. And, you know, it, part of it has to do with what you were talking about. Part of it has to do with there being a myriad of other sports that are available for our athletic players to play in. As far as the pay to play, the youth system that we have here, I mean, so let's take FC Dallas, right? They've got the FC Dallas Academy. I know my daughters have wanted, you know, when they play soccer, they play up against the FC Dallas 4 or 5 year old teams. But you look into playing for those, you know, I was like, oh, well, I wonder if my daughter should play with them, or the Liverpool Academy team here that's in the Frisco area. And it is mind-blowingly expensive. And when you're looking at a really large sum of money to get your kids into playing the beautiful, I mean, the reason why soccer is the most popular sport is because you need a ball and something you can call a goal, and then you play soccer. When you've got kids paying $500-$700 a year just to be on a team, plus travel fees and uniform fees and all that stuff, you're really pricing out a lot of talent when they can go to Pee Wee Sports and Pee Wee Football, and, you know, people donate pads and equipment and in the low income areas, and you can just, and you've got a tremendous support for basketball and football, getting underprivileged kids and even, you know, some middle class neighborhood teams going. And you just don't see that with soccer as much. Maybe you do. I haven't seen that here and I haven't heard of it. So I would say that's probably a good place to start. Now, the question is, where does that money come from? Does it come from the MLS teams? Does it come from, you know, where does that money come from?
Yeah, so I think that money does come from the league in a lot of situations. I think that the growing amount of TV revenue that they'll have once they get the new deal done in a couple of years is going to be a part of that. I think U.S. soccer, in the same sense, needs to kind of do needs to make sure that they're doing a good job of that. One area that I do think is the development academies and the way that those are set up and creating a system that allows for, so the way that they have it is they have a territorial system for a lot of these, and somebody may correct us if we're wrong, but my basic understanding is that FC Dallas, for instance, has territory that they can recruit players from actively, But if they get organically approached by players, they're able to sign them or bring them into the academy system. The issue that players often have is by the time that they're 14 or 15, they're kind of being told, hey, you probably can make it to college, or hey, you could probably make it to the U17 team, but you're going to ride the bench and you maybe play D2, but you're definitely not someone that's going to be on the like the senior squad. And, or the opposite, they're going to make it to the senior squad by the time they're 17. And that's a decision that's tough for players to make sometimes. So once you get them in the system, that's the next level that you need to have some commitment to a player to say, look, you can pursue the professional career and you can pursue that. And you don't have to worry about college because the league will cover your tuition or whatever when you decide to go back to it, if you would like to. And if nothing else, you have a coaching system, right? Like you can go into coaching. That creates a system that makes it so that it's easier for players to make decisions like that. The next thing that you mentioned is where does all the money come from for like the younger kids and stuff? And I think that you should look at the way that the German league and the German system is developed. There's a really good, really, really good book that I got like 3/4 of the way through. And then I think I had a kid or something, but it's called Das Reboot, right? And it's Raphael Hollenstein, the guy that writes for The Guardian. And he comes on, or he writes about how German soccer after 2014, or I'm sorry, the 2002 World Cup really went gung-ho on recreating the system of German football from the ground up. And it started with an emphasis on having qualified, trained coaches, and starting with people like, if you coach your daughter's teams, instead of saying, hey, yeah, dad, you can coach the daughter's team, saying, yeah, dad, you can coach the daughter's teams. Every dad who's never coached will be at this coaching class on this Saturday, the 2 weeks before the season starts. If you want to coach, you got to be there. And getting guys signed up, because right now you look at like a peewee football or whatever, and you probably have the NFL putting out dossiers on how to be a protective coach, because A, they want to cover their ass when it comes to lawsuits, but B, there's just been this long history of that. Whereas in soccer, people think it's like a game of just like, there's no technical skill really involved at that age. It's all about having fun. And yes, that's true, but there should be some strategy and strategic mindset behind the way that you coach starting at a 5, 6, 7-year-old level and moving up from there. Right. And obviously within each of those, you have different degrees of coaching, but that type of a mindset and creating all of these qualified coaches is what funnels players into academies that allow them to get spotted, allow them to develop at a younger age, because now you may go to a coaching clinic and there, and you may not have anybody spectacular this season on your team, but you may meet somebody who is with the FC Dallas team and they're looking for some talented 9 to 10-year-olds. And next thing you know, you've got a girl on your team that you say, you know, you're really good on our team. You really shouldn't play for us. You should go to this team. Let me talk to the guy from FC Dallas and get you signed up. So I think it starts with coaching and goes from there.
Sure. And just so you know, that book, Das Reboot, that we'll have a link to that on our webpage, DallasSoccerShow.com. And Per Mertesacker, the Arsenal defender, described it as a beautiful story, expertly told.
Yes, he did. And the reason why it's a good story is because it kind of starts from Germany losing the World Cup in 2002 to kind of the World Cup final, and then kind of saying, why do we play such uninventive, uninspiring football as a country, and yet we have such good players at times that are some of the best in the world? And our national team is not indicative of that. Whereas the United States' problem is the exact opposite. We create a couple of good players here and there, and then next thing you know, we have a national team that's greater than the sum of the parts. And so, again, it starts with coaching, but as far as the players are concerned, I think it's important to take a step back and look at the World Cup and the qualifying right now. If the U.S. were to not qualify for the World Cup, it would indeed set the game of soccer back a good 5 or 6 years, I feel. The World Cup's huge for the country to get behind the team. The women obviously always qualify, but for the men to not qualify would be massive.
It's just like
that said.
It's just like the Stanley Cup finals. That's the only time most people in America watch hockey, And the world.
Yeah, like you remember when hockey went on the lockout, yeah. right? Like it lost a huge chunk of its fan base because it just wasn't on.
Yep. And then, you know, it, with the World Cup, I remember my, I was at work the last one, and we would, a bunch of people who really didn't care about soccer, they would, they were wearing United States colors and meeting up in the break room to watch the games. So, yeah.
Yeah, it really draws non-soccer fans together and kind of teaches you, because people think that, oh, we're the United States, we suck at soccer. But then they find out, oh, we have a couple of good players and maybe we have a couple more. And so it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
So that, I think that people need to step back. We're still in the qualifying spot. We've got two more matches left that we really should take 6 points from and qualify for. That being said, it's going to require players to really step up and understand that there is some heat. And I think players are starting to feel it domestically. I think that the MLS-based players know and will have heard Alexi Lawless's comments. By saying Wonder Kid, that means that the guys over in Germany and in Europe will have heard this. And it's going to send a message to Arena. I think that these next two matches are really the most important matches that he can coach. And it's going to require Arena to actually do some coaching with regards to how he sets up. And the way he picks his players is going to make a big difference, because if you can rebound from these poor performances and have two really solid matches going into the friendlies before the World Cup next season, it's going to be a fantastic way to start that. And you can completely turn the narrative around. And that's what would make him a good coach. Not whether or not he qualifies. It's the way that he does it. And if he sets a tone going into 2018 for us performing well in Russia.
Yeah, momentum is everything in sports. So the next two international games for the U.S. are Panama and Trinidad and Tobago, correct?
And yep. We play Panama here in Orlando, and then they fly all the way down to just off the coast of Colombia or Venezuela and play Trinidad and Tobago.
Awesome. And then also on Saturday, FC Dallas has plays host to Seattle, and that should be a tough Western Conference matchup there. We've got to get some, at least a point, maybe we almost need to get all 3 points out of this game to even.
I think FC Dallas needs a win. I think when you look at our past run of form,
it's bad.
We need a win. Yeah, well, it's bad, but at the same time, here's what happens. If you look at when you look at the past winners of the MLS Cup, which is a cup competition, Brad Friedel said something and during the broadcast this weekend that said FC Dallas, they were the champions of MLS in 2016 because they won the Supporters Shield, which is the league or the entire season long tournament, which is all the matches. They won that. They had the most points from all their matches. And then they also won the US Open Cup. They didn't win MLS Cup, but the cup competition is, in his opinion, secondary. And that's somebody who has experience playing in leagues that award championships based on your actual season and not a mini tournament. And so that was an important part to think about. But he also has mentioned that the guys that win Supporters Shield, that perform the best over the course of the season, don't always win MLS Cup. They, for whatever reason, don't always have that momentum that they finished the season or that they had throughout the season when they finish it. And FC Dallas finds itself in prime position to have the opposite problem, right? You could go into the playoffs with momentum. We've got some easy matchups. We got two matches against Colorado before the playoffs. We play Minnesota United up north. That'll be a match that we can look to take 3 points at. And then Orlando City is a team that has some talent and probably will give us a good run for our money. But I would not be surprised if we were able to get a result in that match. I just feel like if it doesn't start this weekend, I can't see it turning around. But this is a perfect match to do that in.
As we said, momentum is very important. And if you want that momentum going into the playoffs, you got to get it somewhere. And it's got to come soon. So, all right, Tristan, that was a good discussion on defense and the U.S. national team. And folks, if you are on Twitter, we are Dallas Soccer, at Dallas Soccer Show. And you could always visit our website at www.dallassoccershow.com. All right, Tristan, have a good week.
All right, sounds good. Thanks for listening.